I am here today. I did put copies of the slides over on that first chair, and we've uploaded them. So if any of you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. I'm here on behalf of two of my colleagues, Terry Anderson and Bruce Barton, who have been primarily responsible for much of the evaluation of the patient-centered medical home initiative. We don't have any financial relationships to disclose. What I'm hoping to do today is to present sort of what our evaluation goals have been around the initiative, why the state decided to do this, some of our methodology around data collection and the results that we've provided back to the practices, and then some discussion of information that we've gotten from the practices through the medical home facilitators that are working with us, and I welcome your input on those as well. The Massachusetts Executive Office of Health and Human Services actually developed this patient-centered medical home initiative back in 2009. One of the goals was to help sustain the Massachusetts healthcare reform initiative that was put forth by the legislature and enacted back in 2006. One of the goals with this initiative is that they're thinking that through this public-private cooperative effort that they can promote the adoption of more medical home models of care for quality and enhanced primary care, something I probably don't have to explain to any of you here today. The Center for Health Policy and Research, CHIPR, was asked to evaluate this multi-payer initiative, which involves all Massachusetts commercial and Medicaid payers and a diverse group of primary care practices. Practices actually applied to be in this initiative, and they were very purposefully selected based on five characteristics: the geographic location within the state, their specialty, so that it covered pediatrics, internal medicine, and family medicine, the racial and ethnic composition of their patient panels, the practice type, looking at, for example, solo practices, multi-specialty group practices, community health centers, hospital-based clinics, and then practice independence, what the ownership was of that practice. So we hoped that we got a pretty representative group of practices across the state. We have both, we were charged to have both qualitative and quantitative aspects of the evaluation, and there are three sort of very overall activities that are being done as part of the evaluative efforts. One is looking at the mastery of patient-centered medical home core competencies, which is the piece I'm going to present to you today. The second was looking at improvements in patient experiences and practice experiences with it, and the third was looking at a select group of clinical outcomes. In addition, there are a number of financial outcomes that are being looked at, as well as sort of the processes, different process measures and performance measures. There are primary research questions that are built into each of those three evaluative components, and the one working on the core competency is, to what extent and how do practices actually become medical homes, trying to understand that process. I'm not going to go through the 12 core competencies here, but they do break out into three categories: practice redesign, consumer engagement, and clinical care management and care coordination. The ones that have an asterisk next to them, I can't point that out here, are ones that are actually a high priority activities for our learning collaboratives. They're things that the practice coaches are working very specifically with the practices. The practices actually knew when they applied to be in this program and were selected, there were a number of requirements of them. There are 8 learning sessions or learning collaboratives. They are 1 or 2 day long in-person sessions over the course of the 3 years of the initiative. Last month, back in September, we were halfway through. That was our 1.5 year mark, and there have been 5 of these to date. There are monthly, hour-long learning session conference calls or webinars. They meet regularly with their medical home facilitators. They're required to submit a host of different data reports, some of them monthly, some of them semi-annually. They participate in a variety of work groups that they can select from, for example, primary care and behavioral health integration. They're required to create and maintain patient registries for a variety of different purposes. Ultimately, they need to obtain PCMH, the NCQA Level 1 recognition. That's their overarching goal. And they need to provide care coordination and clinical care management services. So that sounds like an awful lot, but it doesn't come without support from the state in trying to meet all of these requirements. So the Commonwealth provides a number of resources to the practices. They have medical home facilitators that work one-on-one with them to achieve their transformational goals. There are those learning collaboratives that I described where the practices learn from expert faculty through in-person conferences or the online courses, as well as learning from each other in terms of those in-person conferences and modules that are done monthly, the webinars. And then they received a lot of support both in the development and the use of their patient registries so that they were fully functional, and that's through which many of the data reports come to us. There are also payments made to a select group of practices. So on one of the graphs that I'm going to show you, some of the practices are labeled as TA plus, so technical assistance plus a payment. There are TAO, technical assistance only practices, and then there's a comparison group of practices. Our methodology in collecting data is very sequential in this mixed method design. So as we collect data, whether it's qualitatively, it is used to help inform the quantitative data that's collected next, and we work back and forth with providing data to the medical home facilitators who provide it then to the practices and then back to us. We've also implemented quantitatively the medical home implementation quotient, the MHIQ, which at baseline collected data from 44 primary care practices. Back in September at our year two mark, we just collected that data again, but I don't have it yet. It comes back to us both at the individual practice level as well as aggregately. We do a lot of qualitative analysis over a number of documents that the practices supply to us. There are focus groups held with the medical home facilitators as a group every 6 months in the first 2 years of the initiative, as well as individual interviews with the medical home facilitators. We wanted to not be a burden on the practice by being in the practice initially, but really using the benefits of the medical home facilitators who get to know the practices really well. But we decided in year three, we would actually spend time in the practices and do some extensive site visits. So they're in the process of creating an algorithm by which they're going to select those 12 practices. There are a number of frequency statistics that we provide to the medical home facilitators and the practices, and we've also been doing some factor analyses of those 9 MHIQ domains, with the goal being that if we could identify some subgroupings within those core competencies, it might help the practices with some very specific activities that they could gear their efforts to incrementally. TransferMed is the group that actually developed the MHIQ. I don't know if many of you are familiar with this. They were heavily engaged in, as JD said, the demonstration project at the national level. They're a wholly owned subsidiary of the American Academy of Family Practice, and the MHIQ was thought to be a warm-up for NCQA being able to meet their level one recognition requirements. It has a number of modules, 9 of them, with a small training component within them. And from what we can tell, it's fairly widely used, but not very often, not very frequently reported. The 9 domains fall into these categories: access, practice management, practice-based services, an overarching PCMH module, and then there's specific modules on team building, quality, HIT, care coordination, and care management. As you can see here, there's a lot of, again, I'm sorry, the mouse isn't working here. The different categories are technical assistance only, technical assistance plus payment. There are 2 different levels of payments to the practices, and then the comparison group. So there's a fair amount of variability, not a huge amount, but some within each of these domains. But what was really striking to us is that on the access domain, not as much variability, but compared to all of the other domains, the practices are performing far less well on access to care and access to information than the other domains. The other interesting point, well, it can't go backwards, but on one of them, practice-based services, they were scoring in the 80 to 90% range, so almost sort of a ceiling effect there, not much room for them to grow. But when we combined all practices, you can see the same pattern. While there are some practices that are performing really well, in general, that interquartile range is pretty low on the access domain compared to all of the other domains. So that was something we wanted to really focus on. When we did the factor analysis with the different domains, we were specifically interested in the access one, and the 15 questions actually break down into 3 very overarching domains: scheduling visits and appointments, communication, and handling requests for urgent or prompt care. The first two, and access again, as probably many of you know, isn't a new thing for practices to be dealing with, but it's something that we hear from the medical home facilitators, particularly under the request for urgent care, that they're not used to doing in terms of a lot of team building and communicating with patients and having them be part of the process to develop the written policies and procedures that they have. The supply and demand of physicians to patients, they haven't necessarily been warmed to having patients be part of developing those processes for how urgent care will be managed in the practices. So it's something that they're struggling a little bit more, although access in general has been a struggle for them. When we presented all of this information to the medical home facilitators in this first year and a half, and they talk with the practices and then come back to us, they tell us that they're not very surprised at all, that the practices have scored fairly low on this access module. When we gave them the information specifically and have built more evaluation and dug deeper into this, what they tell us is that very few practices actually had written standards, policies, and procedures around scheduling office visits. And even fewer of them were employing quality improvement techniques like the PDSA cycles that were spoken about earlier, about writing policies and procedures. They sort of felt that once the procedure was written, the competency was met, that it was done, that they didn't need to do anything more about that. Practices haven't necessarily considered the function of scheduling visits to be more than something the front office staff are dealing with. And so they haven't really taken a team approach to that in communicating, including the front office staff as well as patients, in deciding on what some of these policies and practices should be. That access to care and information module has been used as a baseline quantitative measure of the enhanced access status, the competency. It is a core competency within the PCMH recognition, and it's defined in this particular initiative as the availability of timely, easy, and flexible access to the practice team, including alternatives to face-to-face visits. So we're trying to work with them and discover how they're using things like data portals and email communication and EMR adaptations, not just for access to information, which is something practices have been open to doing, but access to care in terms of working through those adaptations for scheduling visits. When seeking the NCQA recognition that we're expecting of them, the practice has to be able to assess its enhanced access policies and practices and the quality improvement techniques they're using. So the medical home facilitators have been coaching the practices about writing access standards and policies, and the requirement is that they apply for NCQA Level 1 recognition by next February. We anticipate there are many practices who are certainly online to do that. There are a few practices we're not quite sure about. The medical home facilitators are also encouraging practices to share their tools of the trade during those learning collaboratives and the learning sessions, including both practice policies and what other EMR adaptations that they've used, that they've adopted to support patient access scheduling. Practices are now beginning to apply PDSA cycling techniques to their written access standards, trying to identify small pieces that they can be working on to incrementally change and improve their access score. So as an example here, one of the goals of practices is that if a patient calls for a non-urgent, a scheduled visit, that the patient will be seen within the third next available appointment. But what they're working on is how many days that is between when the patient calls and when that third next appointment is, and trying to truly decrease the number of days to that. And then finally, the medical home facilitators are coaching the practices to truly understand what this enhanced access module is, how it fits into the core competencies of being a patient-centered medical home, and how many of these core competencies actually are integrated with one another. So as an example, access really is central to building a multidisciplinary team, and that's another one of the core competencies. So helping them to understand that working on one often is very instructive in terms of working on another one. And Valerie Konar is our project director, who can answer any and every question about this, but I'm happy to try answering any that you have now.
What differentiates one is doing well versus doing poorly? I differentiate those that are doing well and those that are doing poorly, especially with priorities and level of special classes. In fact, part of the work that's given is very important.
It's absolutely a question that we have, one that I don't think we have the answer to yet, but it's certainly something when we look at how does a practice become a medical home, it clearly is looking at what are the different adoptions that they're taking in terms of both their provider panel and their patient panel, but remains to be seen. So we're in the process of doing that now because now is the time where we're actually calculating payments to the practice. So the way the procurement, the contracts are written in Massachusetts, we have to have that the year one activities are factoring into what their year one payment is, but that's not happening until right now during year two. And it's at the end of year two that they'll figure out sort of the year two payments and at the end of year three. But those first set of payments, which are based on three different factors. There's a bolus of monies that each of the practices got in that TA Plus module, a lot of that for building infrastructure like the patient registry. There was a smaller bolus that they got at the beginning of time two, but the calculations really are based on what their performance has been in a number of these PCMH activities. So the core of the payment they're getting is really based on a per member per month calculation of general PCMH activities, as well as a per member per month calculation for care coordination, actually looking at how much time is developed and utilized there. And they call them risk adjustment. It's really by age category. So there's a certain payment for 0 to 17, twice the payment for 18 to 64, and four times the payment for the 65-plus composition. And then ultimately, there are payments for shared cost savings between the practices and the payers. And so a lot of that still remains to be seen as they're calculating them. The procurement's going on right now in terms of their year one activity. So I wish I could answer that. One of the focus areas for them has been around leadership and pulling together that team, but really having leadership that could, as you suggest, really bring the team together in a much more, other than an ad hoc way, work toward those outcomes. So leadership has been a key piece that they've been very specifically working on.